A mistake, we haven't found it yet. The respect was obvious in local's voice. A person like this plans every move from the viewpoint that someone will come looking later.
Sounds like Marley,
Fitch said, as if he were admiring a daughter. She had two credit cards in Lawrence, a Visa and a Shell gas card. Her credit history revealed nothing remarkable or helpful. Evidently, most of her expenditures were in cash. No telephone cards either. She wouldn't dare make that mistake. Jeff Kerr was a different story. His trail to law school at KU had been easy to follow, most of the work having been done by Fitch's initial operatives. Only after he met Claire did he pick up her habits of secrecy. They left Lawrence in the summer of 1991, after his second year of law school, and Local's men had yet to find anyone who knew exactly when they left or where they were going. Claire had paid cash for the June rent that year, then vanished. They had spot-checked a dozen cities for signs of a Claire Clement after May of 1991, but so far had found nothing helpful. For obvious reasons, it was not possible to check every city. My guess is that she ditched Claire as soon as she left town and became someone else, Local said. Fitch had figured this out long ago.
This is Saturday. The jury gets the case on Monday. Let's forget what happened after Lawrence and concentrate on finding out who she really is.
We're working on that now.
Work harder.
Fitch glanced at his watch and explained that he had to go. Marley would be expecting him in a matter of moments. Local left for a private plane and a quick trip back to Kansas City. Marley had been in her little office since 6. She slept little after Nicholas called her around 3. They talked 4 times before he left for the courtroom. The Hoppy scam had Fitch stamped all over it. Why else would Mr. Cristano threaten to crush Hoppy if he didn't pressure Millie to vote right? Marley had scribbled pages of notes and flowcharts, and she'd made dozens of calls on her cell phone. Information was trickling in. The only George Cristano with a listed phone number in the metropolitan D.C. area lived in Alexandria. Marley had called him around 4 a.m. and explained she was so-and-so with Delta Airlines, a plane had gone down near Tampa, a Mrs. Cristano was on board, and was this the George Cristano who worked with the Justice Department? No, he worked at Health and Human Services, thank God. She apologized, hung up, and snickered at the thought of the poor man racing to CNN to see the story. Dozens of similar calls had led her to believe that there were no FBI agents working out of Atlanta named Napier and Nitchman, nor were there any in Biloxi, New Orleans, Mobile, or any nearby city. At 8, she made contact with an investigator in Atlanta who was now pursuing leads on Napier and Nitchman. Marley and Nicholas were almost positive the two were stooges, but this had to be confirmed. She called reporters, cops, FBI hotlines, government information services. When Fitch arrived, promptly at 10, the table was clear and the phone was hidden in a small closet. They barely said hello. Fitch was wondering who she was before she was Claire, and she was still analyzing the next move to uncover his Hoppy scam.
You'd better wrap it up, Fitch. The jury is numb.
We'll be through by 5 this afternoon. That's soon enough.
Let's hope so. You're not making it easier on Nicholas.
I've told Cable to hurry. That's all I can do.
We got problems with Ricky Coleman. Nicholas has spent time with her, and she'll be a hard sell. She's well-respected on the jury by the men and women alike, and Nicholas says she's slowly becoming a major player. He's surprised by this, actually.
She wants a big verdict?
It looks that way, though they haven't discussed specifics. Nicholas detects a real bitterness toward the industry for duping kids into addiction. She doesn't appear to have much sympathy for the Wood family. She's more inclined to punish Big Tobacco for hooking the younger generation. Anyway, you said we might have a surprise for her.
Without comment or formality, Fitch lifted a single sheet of paper from his briefcase and slid it across the table. Marley scanned it quickly.
Abortion, huh? She said, still reading, unsurprised.
Yep.
You're sure this is her?
Positive she was in college.
This should do it.
Does he have the guts to show it to her?
Marley released the paper and glared at Fitch.
Would you for $10 million?
Of course. And why not? She sees this, she votes right. This is forgotten, and her dirty little secret is safe. She leans the other way, then threats are made. It's an easy sell.
Precisely.
She folded the piece of paper and removed it from the table.
Don't worry about Nick's courage, okay? We've been planning this for a long time.
How long?
That's not important. You have nothing on Herman Grimes?
Not a thing. Nicholas will have to deal with him during deliberations.
Gee, thanks.
He's damn sure getting paid for it, don't you think? For $10 million, you'd think he should be able to sway a few votes.
He's got the votes, Fitch. They're in his pocket right now. He wants it unanimous. Herman might be a problem.
Then bump the son of a bitch. Seems to be a game you enjoy.
We're thinking about it.
Fitch shook his head in amazement. Do you realize how utterly corrupt this is?
Yes, I think so.
I love it.
Go love it somewhere else, Fitch. That's all for now. I have work to do.
Yes, dear, Fitch said, bouncing to his feet and closing his briefcase.
Early Saturday afternoon, Marley located an FBI agent in Jackson, Mississippi, who happened to be at the office catching up with paperwork when the phone rang. She gave an alias, said she was employed by a real estate company in Biloxi, and suspected two men of posing as FBI agents when in fact they were not. The two men had been harassing her boss, making threats, flashing badges, etc. She thought they had something to do with the casinos, and for good measure she threw in the name of Jimmy Hull Moak. He gave her the home number of a young FBI agent in Biloxi named Madden. Madden was in bed with flu, but willing to talk nonetheless, especially when Marley informed him she might have confidential information about Jimmy Hull Moak. Madden had never heard of either Napier or Nitchman, and hadn't heard of Cristano either. He was unaware of any special crime-fighting unit from Atlanta now operating on the coast, and the more she talked, the more excited he became. He wanted to investigate a bit, and she promised to call him back in an hour. He sounded much stronger when she phoned later. There was no FBI agent named Nitchman. There was a Lance Napier in the San Francisco office, but he would have no business on the coast. Cristano was likewise a bogus identity. Madden had talked to the agent in charge of the investigation into Jimmy Hull Moak and confirmed that Nitchman, Napier, and Cristano, whoever they might be, were certainly not FBI agents. He'd love to talk to these boys, and Marley said she'd try to arrange a meeting. The defense rested at 3 Saturday afternoon. Judge Harkin announced proudly, "Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard the last witness." There would be some last-minute motions and arguments for him and the lawyers to tend to, but the jurors were free to go. For their Saturday night entertainment, one bus would travel to a junior college football game, and the other would go to a local movie theater. Afterward, personal visits would be allowed until midnight. For tomorrow, each juror would be allowed to leave the motel from 9 a.m. until 1 for worship services, unsupervised as long as they promised not to say a word to anybody about the trial. For Sunday night, personal visits from 7 until 10. First thing Monday, they would hear closing arguments and receive the case before lunch. Chapter 35. Explaining football to Henry Vu was more trouble than it was worth. But then everyone seemed to be an expert. Nicholas had played high school junior varsity in Texas, no less, where the sport is something only slightly less than a religion. Jerry followed 20 games a week, followed in fact with his wallet, and thus claimed to know the game intimately. Lonnie, sitting behind Henry, had also played in high school and was quick to lean over his shoulder and point. The poodle, sitting next to Jerry, closely under the quilt, had learned the game thoroughly when her two sons played. Even Shine Royce didn't hesitate to throw in a few pointers. He'd never played the game, but watched a lot of television. They sat in a tiny, huddled group on the visitor's side, on cold aluminum bleachers, away from the rest of the crowd, watching a Gulf Coast school play one from Jackson. It was a perfect football setting. Cool weather, nice crowd on the home side, a rowdy band in the stands, cute cheerleaders, close score. Henry asked all the wrong questions. Why are their trousers so tight? What do they say when they group together between plays, and why do they hold hands? Why do they pile up like that? He claimed it was his first live football game. Across an aisle, Chuck and another deputy watched the game in plain clothes, ignoring six of the jurors in the most important civil trial in the country. It was expressly forbidden for any juror to have contact with another juror's visitors.
The prohibition had been in writing since the beginning of sequestration, and Judge Harkin had harped on it repeatedly. But an occasional hello in the hallway was unavoidable, and Nicholas had been especially determined to violate the rule whenever possible. Millie had no interest in movies, and certainly none in football. Hoppy arrived with a sack of burritos, which they ate slowly with few words. After dinner, they tried to watch a TV show, but finally gave it up and began to rehash Hoppy's mess. There were more tears, more apologies, even a few of Hoppy's casual references to suicide, which Millie found a bit overly dramatic. She finally confessed she'd spilled her guts to Nicholas Easter, a fine young man who knew the law and could be trusted implicitly. Hoppy at first was shocked and angry. Then his curiosity got the better of him, and he longed to know what someone else thought of his situation, especially someone who'd studied the law, as Millie said. More than once she'd mentioned her admiration for the young man. Nicholas had promised to make a few calls, and this alarmed Hoppy. Oh, how Nitschmann and Napier and Cristano lectured him on the necessity of silence. Nicholas could be trusted, Millie repeated, and Hoppy eventually warmed to the idea. The phone rang at 10:30. It was Nicholas, back from the game, settled in his room and anxious to meet with the Duprees. Millie unlocked the door. Willis watched with great surprise from the end of the hall as Easter sneaked into Millie's room. Was her husband still in there? He couldn't remember. Many of the guests had yet to leave, and he'd been napping anyway. Surely Easter and Millie weren't seeing each other. Willis made a mental note of it, then drifted back to sleep. Hoppy and Millie sat on the edge of the bed facing Nicholas, who leaned on the dresser near the TV. He began by lecturing them kindly on the need for silence, as if Hoppy hadn't heard this in the past week. They were violating a judge's orders. Enough said. He broke the news gently. Napier, Nitschmann, and Cristano were minor players in a large fraud, a conspiracy orchestrated by the tobacco company to pressure Millie. They were not government agents. The names were aliases. Hoppy had been duped. He took it well. At first he felt even more stupid, if that was possible. Then the room began to spin as Hoppy got yanked this way and that. Was it good news or bad? What about the tape? What was his next move? What if Nicholas was wrong? 100 thoughts raced through his overloaded brain as Millie squeezed his knee and started crying. "Are you sure?" he was able to ask, his voice on the verge of cracking. "Positive. They have no connection with either the FBI or the Department of Justice."
But they had badges?"
And Nicholas raised both hands, nodded compassionately, and said, "I know, Hoppy. Believe me, that stuff was easy. The cover was simple to create." Hoppy rubbed his forehead and tried to arrange things. Nicholas went on to explain that KLX Property Group in Las Vegas was a sham. They had been unable to find a Mr. Todd Ringwald, which was almost certainly an alias, too.
"How do you know all this?" Hoppy asked.
"Good question. I have a close friend on the outside who's very good at digging for information. He is completely trustworthy. Took about 3 hours on the phone, which is not bad, considering it's Saturday." 3 hours. On a Saturday. Why hadn't Hoppy made a few calls? He'd had a week. He sunk lower until his elbows rested on his knees. Millie wiped her cheeks with a tissue. A quiet minute passed.
"What about the tape?"
Hoppy asked. "Of you and Moak?"
"Yes, that tape."
"I'm not worried about it," Nicholas said confidently, as if he was now Hoppy's lawyer. "Legally, there are lots of problems with the tape." "Tell me about it," Hoppy thought, but said nothing. Nicholas continued. "It was obtained by false pretenses. It's a clear case of entrapment. It's in the possession of men who themselves are violating the law. It was not obtained by law enforcement officials. There was no search warrant for it, no court order allowing your words to be recorded. Forget it." What sweet words! Hoppy's shoulders jerked upward and he exhaled mightily.
"You're serious?"
"Yes, Hoppy. The tape will never be played again." Millie leaned over and clutched Hoppy, and they hugged without shame or embarrassment. Her tears were now of unbridled joy. Hoppy jumped to his feet and bounced around the room.
"So what's the game plan?" he asked, cracking his knuckles, ready for battle.
"We have to be careful,"
Just point me in the right direction. The bastards!
Hoppy!
Sorry, dear. I'm just ready to kick some ass.
Your language!
Sunday began with a birthday cake. Loreen Duke had mentioned to Mrs. Gladys Card that her 36th birthday was approaching. Mrs. Card called her sister out in the free world, and early Sunday her sister delivered a thick chocolate caramel cake, 3 layers with 36 candles. The jurors met in the dining room at 9 and ate the cake for breakfast. Most then left in a hurry for 4 hours of much-awaited worship. Some had not been to church in years, but felt drawn by the spirit. One of Poodle's boys picked her up, and Jerry tagged along. They headed in the general direction of some unnamed church, but as soon as they realized no one was watching, they went to a casino instead. Nicholas left with Marley, and they attended Mass. Mrs. Gladys Card made a grand entrance at the Calvary Baptist Church. Millie went home with good intentions of dressing for church, but she was overcome with emotion at the sight of her kids. No one was watching, so she spent her time in the kitchen, cooking and cleaning and doting on her brood. Philip Savell remained behind. Hoppy went to his office at 10. He had called Napier at 8 Sunday morning with the news that he had important trial developments to discuss, said he'd made much progress with his wife, and she was now scoring major points with other jurors. He wanted to meet with Napier and Nitschmann at his office to give a full report and to receive further instructions. Napier took the call in a run-down two-room apartment he and Nitschmann were using as a front for the scam. 2 phone lines were temporarily installed, one as the office number, the other as their residence for the duration of their hard-charging investigation into corruption along the Gulf Coast. Napier chatted with Hoppy, then called Cristano for orders. Cristano's room was at a Holiday Inn near the beach. Cristano in turn called Fitch, who was delighted with the news. Finally, Millie was off dead center and moving their way. Fitch had begun to wonder if his investment would pay off. He green-lighted the meeting at Hoppy's office. Wearing their standard dark suits and dark sunshades, Napier and Nitschmann arrived at the office at 11 to find Hoppy brewing coffee and in great spirits. They settled around his desk and waited for the coffee. Millie was in there fighting like hell to save her husband, Hoppy said, and she felt quite confident she had already convinced Mrs. Gladys Card and Ricky Coleman. She had shared the Robilio memo with them, and they had been shocked at the man's deceit. He poured coffee as Napier and Nitschmann dutifully took notes. Another guest quietly entered the building through the front door, which had been left unlocked by Hoppy. He eased along the hall behind the open reception area, stepping lightly on the worn carpet until he came to a wooden door with Hoppy Dupree painted on it. He listened for a moment, then knocked loudly. Inside, Napier jumped, and Nitschmann set down his coffee, and Hoppy stared at them as if startled. "Who is it?" he growled loudly. The door opened suddenly, and Special Agent Alan Madden stepped in, said loudly, "FBI!" while walking to the edge of Hoppy's desk and glaring at all three. Hoppy kicked his chair back and stood as if he might have to get frisked. Napier would have fainted had he been standing. Nitschmann's mouth dropped open. Both turned pale as their hearts stopped. "Agent Alan Madden, FBI," he said as he opened his badge for all to inspect. "Are you Mr. Dupree?" he demanded.
"Yes, but the FBI's already here," Hoppy said, looking at Madden, then at the other two, then back at Madden.
"Where?" he asked, scowling down at Napier and Nitschmann.
"These two guys,"
Hoppy said, acting brilliantly. It was his finest moment.
"This is Agent Ralph Napier, and this is Agent Dean Nitschmann. You guys don't know each other?"
"I can explain," Napier started, nodding confidently as if he could, in fact, make everything satisfactory.
"FBI," Madden said.
"Show me some identification," he demanded, shoving forward an empty palm. They hesitated, and Hoppy pounced on them.
"Go ahead. Show them your badges, same ones you showed me."
"Identification, please," Madden insisted, his anger growing by the second. Napier started to stand, but Madden returned him to his seat by pressing down on his shoulder.
"I can explain," Nitschmann said, his voice an octave higher than normal.
"Go ahead,"
Madden said. Well, you see, we're not really FBI agents, but instead...
What?
Hoppy screamed from across the desk. He was wild-eyed and ready to throw something.
You lying son of a bitch! You've been telling me for the last 10 days that you're FBI agents!
Is that true? Madden demanded.
Not really, Nitschman said.
What?
Hoppy screamed again.
Cool it, Madden snapped at him.
Now continue, he said to Nitschman. Nitschman didn't want to continue. He wanted to bolt through the door, kiss Biloxi goodbye, and never be seen again.
We're private investigators, and, well, we work for a firm in D.C., Napier chimed in helpfully.
He was about to add something else when Hoppy lunged for a desk drawer, yanked it open, and removed two business cards, one for Ralph Napier, one for Dean Nitschman, both labeled as FBI agents, both from the Southeast Regional Unit in Atlanta. Madden studied both cards, saw the local numbers scrawled on the back.
"What's going on here?" Hoppy demanded.
"Who's Nitschman?" Madden asked. There was no answer.
"He's Nitschman!"
Hoppy yelled, pointing at Nitschman.
"Not me," Nitschman said.
"What?"
Hoppy screamed. Madden took two steps toward Hoppy and pointed at his chair. "I want you to sit down and shut up, okay? Not another word until I ask for it."
Hoppy fell into his seat, his eyes glaring fiercely at Nitschman.
"Are you Ralph Napier?" Madden asked.
"Nope," Napier said, looking down, away from Hoppy.
"Son of a bitches," Hoppy mumbled.
"Then who are you?" Madden asked. He waited, but there was no response.
"They gave me those cards, okay?"
Hoppy said, not about to keep quiet.
"I'll go to the grand jury and swear on a stack of Bibles that they gave me those cards. They've held themselves out as FBI agents, and I want them prosecuted."
"Who are you?" Madden asked the one previously known as Nitschman. No response. Madden then removed a service revolver, an action that greatly impressed Hoppy, and made the two stand and spread their legs and lean forward on the desk. A quick frisk of each revealed nothing but pocket change, some keys, and a few dollars. No wallets, no fake FBI badges, no identification whatsoever. They were too well trained to make that mistake. He handcuffed them and led them from the office to the front of the building, where another FBI agent was sipping coffee from a paper cup and waiting. Together, they loaded Napier and Nitschman into the back of a real FBI car. Madden said goodbye to Hoppy, promised to call him later, and drove away with the two stooges in the back seat sitting on their hands. The other FBI agent followed in the fake FBI car Napier always drove. Hoppy waved farewell. Madden drove along Highway 90 in the direction of Mobile. Napier, the quicker wit of the two, concocted a fairly reasonable story, which Nitschman added to slightly. They explained to Madden that their firm had been hired by some vague and unnamed casino interests to investigate various parcels of real estate along the coast. This is where they'd run into Hoppy, who was quite corrupt, and had tried to shake him down for cash. One thing led to another, and their boss made them pose as FBI agents. No harm had been done, really. Madden listened with hardly a word. They would later tell Fitch that he seemed not to have a clue about Hoppy's wife Millie and her current civic responsibilities. He was a young agent, obviously amused with his catch and not certain what to do with them. For his part, Madden deemed it a minor offense, unworthy of prosecution, certainly not worth any more effort on his part. His caseload was staggering anyway. The last thing he needed was to waste time pursuing convictions for two small-time liars. When they crossed into Alabama, he delivered a stern lecture on the penalties for impersonating a federal officer. They were truly sorry. It would never happen again. He stopped at a rest station, uncuffed them, gave them their car, and told them to stay out of Mississippi. They thanked him profusely, promised never to return, and sped away. Fitch broke a lamp with his fist when he got the call from Napier. Blood dripped from a knuckle as he seethed and cursed and listened to the story, as told from a noisy truck stop somewhere in Alabama. He sent Pang to collect the two. 3 hours after they were first handcuffed, Napier and Nitschman were seated in a room next to Fitch's office in the rear of the old dime store. Cristano was present.
"Start at the beginning," Fitch said. "I want to hear every word."
He punched a button, and a recorder started. They painstakingly collaborated on the narrative until they'd recollected virtually all of it. Fitch dismissed them and sent them back to Washington. Alone, he dimmed the lights in his office and sulked in the darkness. Hoppy would tell Millie tonight. Millie would be lost as a defense juror. In fact, she'd probably swing so far to the other side she'd want billions in damages for the poor widow Wood. Marley could salvage this disaster. Only Marley. Chapter 36. It was the strangest thing, Phoebe said, not long into the surprise call from Beverly, because the day before yesterday some guy had called her, too, claimed he was Jeff Kerr looking for Claire. She knew immediately the guy was faking, but she strung him along anyway to see what he wanted. She hadn't talked to Claire in 4 years. Beverly and Phoebe compared notes about their calls, though Beverly didn't mention the meeting with Swanson or the jury trial he was investigating. They reminisced about the college days in Lawrence, which seemed so long ago. They lied about their acting careers and the speed with which each was progressing. They promised to get together at the first opportunity. Then they said goodbye. Beverly called back an hour later as if she'd forgotten something. She'd been thinking about Claire. They'd parted on less than good terms, and this bothered her. It was a trivial matter they'd never resolved. She wanted to see Claire to patch things up, if for no other reason than to relieve the guilt. But she didn't have a clue where to find her. Claire had disappeared so fast and so thoroughly. At this point, Beverly decided to take a chance. Since Swanson had mentioned the possibility of a prior name, and since she remembered the mystery surrounding Claire's past, she decided to cast the bait and see if Phoebe would take it. Claire was not her real name, you know, she said, acting quite effectively. Yeah, I know, Phoebe said. She told me once, but I can't remember now. Phoebe hesitated. She had the prettiest name. Not that Claire was bad. What was it? Gabrielle. Oh, yes, Gabrielle. And what was her last name? Brandt. Gabrielle Brandt. She was from Columbia, Missouri. That's where she went to school, at the university there. Did she tell you the story? Maybe, but I don't remember. She had a boyfriend who was abusive and crazy. She tried to ditch him and he began stalking her. That's why she left town and changed her name. Never heard that. What's her parents' name? Brandt. I think her father's dead. Her mother was a professor of medieval studies at the university. Is she still there? I have no idea. I'll try to find her through her mom. Thanks, Phoebe. It took an hour to get Swanson on the phone. Beverly asked him how much the information was worth. Swanson called Fitch, who needed some good news. He authorized a ceiling of $5,000, and Swanson called her back with an offer of half that. She wanted more. They negotiated for 10 minutes and settled on $4,000, which she wanted in cash and in hand, before she'd say a word. All four of the CEOs were in town for the closing arguments and the verdict, so Fitch had a small fleet of finely appointed corporate jets at his disposal. He sent Swanson to New York on the Pinex plane. Swanson arrived in the city at dusk and checked into a small hotel near Washington Square. According to a roommate, Beverly was not in, was not working, but she might be at a party. He called the pizzeria where she worked and was told she had been fired. He called the roommate again and got himself hung up on when he asked too many questions. He slammed the phone down and stomped around his room. How the hell do you find a person on the streets of Greenwich Village? He walked a few blocks to her apartment, his feet freezing in the cold rain. He drank coffee where he'd met her before while his shoes thawed and dried. He used a pay phone for another fruitless chat with the same roommate. Marley wanted one last meeting before the big Monday. They met in her little office. Fitch could have kissed her feet when he saw her. He decided to tell her everything about Hoppy and Millie and his great scam gone bad. Nicholas had to work on Millie immediately to soothe her before she contaminated her friends. After all, Hoppy had told Napier and Nitschman early Sunday that Millie was now a fierce advocate for the defense, that she was in there showing copies of the Robilio memo to her comrades. Was this true?
If so, what in the world would she do now when she learned the truth about Hoppy? She'd be furious, no doubt. She'd flip-flop immediately. She'd probably tell her friends what a heinous thing the defense had done to her husband in an effort to pressure her. It would be a disaster, no question about it. Marley listened straight-faced as Fitch unraveled the story. She wasn't shocked, but quite amused to see Fitch sweat.
"I think we should bump her," Fitch declared when he was finished.
"Do you have a copy of the Robilio memo?" she asked, completely unmoved. He picked one out of his briefcase and handed it to her. "Some of your work?" she asked after she'd read it.
"Yes, it's completely bogus."
She folded it and placed it under her chair. "A hell of a scam, Fitch."
"Yeah, it was beautiful until we got caught."
"Is this something you do in every tobacco trial?"
"We certainly try."
"Why'd you pick Mr. Dupree?"
"We studied him carefully and decided he'd be easy. Small-town realtor, barely paying his bills, lots of money changing hands with the casinos and all, lots of his friends making big bucks. He fell for it immediately."
"Have you been caught before?"
"We've had to abort scams, but we've never been caught red-handed."
"Until today?"
"Not really. Hoppy and Millie might suspect it was somebody working for the tobacco company, but they don't know who. So in that respect, there's still some doubt."
"What's the difference?"
"None."
"Relax, Fitch. I think her husband may have been exaggerating her effectiveness. Nicholas and Millie are quite close, and she hasn't become an advocate for your client."
"Our client?"
"Right, our client. Nicholas hasn't seen the memo."
"You think Hoppy was lying?"
"Would you blame him? Your boys had him convinced he was about to be indicted."
Fitch breathed a little easier and almost smiled. He said, "It's imperative Nicholas talk to Millie tonight. Hoppy will go over in a couple of hours and tell her all about it. Can Nicholas get to her quickly?"
"Fitch, Millie will vote the way he wants. Relax."
Fitch relaxed. He removed his elbows from the table and tried to smile again. "Just out of curiosity, how many votes do we have right now?"
9.
"Who are the other 3?
Herman, Ricky, and Lonnie."
"He hasn't discussed Ricky's past with her?"
"Not yet."
"That'll make 10, Fitch said, his eyes dancing, his fingers suddenly twitching. "We can get 11 if we can bump somebody and pick up Shine Royce, right?"
"Look, Fitch, you're worrying too much. You've paid your money, you've hired the best, now relax and wait on your verdict. It's in very good hands."
"Unanimous?" Fitch asked gleefully.
"Nicholas is determined to bring it back unanimous."
Fitch sprang down the steps of the sagging building and bounced along the short sidewalk until he hit the street. For 6 blocks, he whistled and almost skipped in the night air. Jose met him on foot and tried to keep up. He'd never seen his boss in such good spirits. On one side of the conference room sat 7 lawyers who'd each paid $1 million for the privilege of sharing this event. No one else was in the room. No one but Wendell Rohr, who stood on the other side of the conference table and paced slowly back and forth, speaking softly with measured words to his jury. His voice was warm and rich, filled with compassion one second and harsh words for big tobacco the next. He lectured and he cajoled. He was comical and he was angry. He showed them photographs and he wrote figures on a chalkboard. He finished in 51 minutes, the shortest rehearsal so far. The closing had to be an hour or less, Harkin's orders. The comments from his peers were fast and mixed, some complimentary, but most probing for ways to improve. No tougher audience could be found. The 7 had combined for hundreds of closing arguments, arguments which had produced close to $500 million in verdicts. They knew how to extract large sums of money from juries. They had agreed to park their egos outside the door. Rohr took another beating, something he didn't do well, and agreed to perform again. It had to be perfect. Victory was so close. Cable underwent similar abuse. His audience was much larger, 12 lawyers, several jury consultants, lots of paralegals. He was videotaped so he could study himself. He was determined to do it in 30 minutes. The jury would be appreciative. Rohr would no doubt run longer. The contrast would be nice. Cable, the technician, sticking to the facts, versus Roar, the flamboyant mouthpiece, tugging at their emotions. He delivered his closing, then watched the video, again and again, throughout Sunday afternoon and deep into the night. By the time Fitch arrived at the beach house, he had managed to work himself back into his usual state of cautious pessimism. The four CEOs were waiting, having just finished a fine meal. Jankel was drunk and kept to himself by the fireplace. Fitch took some coffee and analyzed the last-minute efforts of the defense. The questions quickly got round to the wire transfers he'd demanded on Friday, $2 million from each of the four. Prior to Friday, the fund had a balance of $6.5 million, certainly more than enough to complete the trial. What was the additional $8 million for? And how much was in the fund now? Fitch explained that the defense had had a sudden, unplanned expenditure of the grandest proportions. "Stop the games, Fitch," said Luther Vandermeer of Tralco. "Have you managed to finally purchase a verdict?" Fitch tried not to lie to these four. They were, after all, his employers. He never told them the complete truth, and they didn't expect him to. But in response to a direct question, especially one of this magnitude, he felt compelled to make some effort at honesty. "Something like that," he said. "Do you have the votes, Fitch?" asked another CEO. Fitch paused and looked carefully at each of the four, including Jankel, who was suddenly attentive. "I believe I do," he said. Jankel jumped to his feet, unsteady but quite focused, and stepped into the center of the room. "Say it again, Fitch," he demanded. "You heard me," Fitch said. "The verdict has been purchased." His voice couldn't resist a touch of pride. The other three stood too. All four eased toward Fitch, forming a loose semicircle. "How?" one of them asked. "I'll never tell," Fitch said coolly. "The details are not important." "I demand to know," Jankel said. "Forget it. Part of my job is to do the dirty work while protecting you and your companies. If you want to terminate me, fine, but you'll never know the details." They stared at him during a long pause. The circle grew tighter. They slowly sipped their drinks and admired their hero. 8 times they'd been to the brink of disaster, and 8 times Rankin Fitch had worked his dirty tricks and saved them. Now he'd done it for the 9th time. He was invincible. And he'd never promised victory before. Not like this. Just the opposite. He'd always anguished before each verdict, always predicting defeat and taking pleasure in making them miserable. This was so uncharacteristic. "How much?" Jankel demanded. It was something Fitch couldn't hide. For obvious reasons, these four had the right to know where the money went. They had installed a primitive accounting format for the fund. Each company contributed equal amounts when Fitch said so, and each CEO was entitled to a monthly list of all expenses. $10 million, Fitch said. The drunk barked first. "You've paid $10 million to a juror." The other three were equally shocked. "No, not to a juror. Let's put it this way. I've purchased the verdict for $10 million, okay? That's all I will say. The fund now has a balance of $4.5 million, and I'm not going to answer any questions about how the money changed hands." "Maybe a sack of cash under the table might make sense. $5,000-$10,000 maybe, but it was impossible to picture any of these small-town hicks on the jury possessing brains big enough to dream of $10 million. Surely it wasn't all going to one person." They hung together near Fitch in stunned silence, each having the same thoughts. Surely Fitch had worked his wizardry on 10 of them. That would make sense. He'd gotten 10 and offered them $1 million each. That made a hell of a lot more sense. 10 fresh new millionaires on the Gulf Coast. But how do you hide that kind of money? Fitch savored the moment. "Of course, nothing is guaranteed," he said. "You never know until the jury comes back." "Well, it damn sure better be guaranteed at the rate of $10 million, but they said nothing. Luther Vandermeer backed away first. He poured a stiffer brandy and sat on the piano bench near the baby grand. Fitch would tell him later.
He'd wait a month or two, get Fitch up to New York on business, and pick the story out of him. Fitch said he had things to do. He wanted each of the four in the courtroom tomorrow for closing arguments. Don't sit together, he instructed. Chapter 37. There was a general feeling among the jurors that Sunday night would be their last in sequestration. They whispered that perhaps if they got the case by noon Monday, then certainly they could reach a verdict by Monday night and go home. This wasn't discussed openly because it necessarily involved speculation about the verdict, something Herman was quick to stifle. The mood was light, though, and many of the jurors quietly packed and tidied up their rooms. They wanted their last visit to the Siesta Inn to be quick, a dash in from court to gather packed bags and grab toothbrushes. Sunday was the third consecutive night of personal visits, and collectively they'd had enough of their mates, especially the married ones. Three straight nights of coziness in a small room was trying for most marriages. Even the singles needed a night off. Savelle's woman friend stayed away. Derek told Angel he might stop by later, but had some important business first. Lorene didn't have a boyfriend, but she'd had enough of her teenage daughters for one weekend. Jerry and Poodle were having their first little spat. The motel was quiet Sunday night. No football and beer in the party room, no checkers tournaments. Marley and Nicholas ate pizza in his room. They covered their checklists and made final plans. Both were nervous and tense, and managed only slight humor at her recounting of Fitch's sad story about Hoppy. Marley left at 9. She drove her leased car to her rented condo, where she finished packing her own things. Nicholas walked across the hall where Hoppy and Millie were waiting like a couple of honeymooners. They couldn't thank him enough. He had exposed this horrible fraud and set them free again. It was shocking to think of the extreme measures the tobacco industry would go just to pressure a juror. Millie expressed her concern about remaining on the jury. She and Hoppy had already discussed it, and she didn't feel she could be fair and impartial in light of what they'd done to her husband. Nicholas had anticipated this. It was his opinion that he needed Millie. And there was a more compelling reason. If Millie told Judge Harkin about the Hoppy scam, then he'd probably declare a mistrial. And that would be a tragedy. A mistrial would mean that in a year or two another jury would be picked to hear the same case. Each side would spend another fortune doing what they were doing right now. It's up to us, Millie. We've been chosen to decide this case, and it's our responsibility to reach a verdict. The next jury will be no smarter than us. I agree, Hoppy said. This trial will be over tomorrow. It'd be a shame to have a mistrial declared here at the last minute. So Millie bit her lip and found new resolve. Her friend Nicholas made everything easier. Cleve met Derek in the sports bar of the Nugget Casino Sunday night. They drank a beer, watched a football game, said little because Derek was pouting and trying to appear angry at the screwing he claimed to be receiving. The $15,000 in cash was in a small brown packet that Cleve slid across the table and which Derek took and stuffed in a pocket without saying thanks or anything. Pursuant to their latest deal, the other $10,000 would be paid after the verdict, assuming, of course, that Angel voted with the plaintiff. "Why don't you leave now?" Derek said a few minutes after the money landed near his heart. "Great idea," Cleve said. "Go see your girlfriend. Explain things carefully." "I can handle her." Cleve took his long neck with him and disappeared. Derek drained his beer and rushed to the men's room, where he locked himself in a stall and counted the money, 150 fresh, new, neatly packed $100 bills. He pressed the stack together and was amazed at its size, less than an inch thick. He divided it in quarters and placed a folded wad in each pocket of his jeans. The casino was bustling. He'd learned to shoot craps from an older brother who'd served in the army, and for some reason, as if drawn by a magnet, he wandered near the crap tables. He watched for a minute, then decided to resist the temptation and go see Angel. He stopped for a quick beer at a small bar overlooking the roulette pit. Everywhere below him, fortunes were being won and lost. It takes money to make money. It was his lucky night. He bought $1,000 worth of chips at a crap table and enjoyed the attention that all big spenders command.
The pit boss examined the unused bills, then smiled at Derek. A blonde waitress appeared from nowhere, and he ordered another beer. Derek bet heavily, heavier than any white person at the table. The first batch of chips disappeared in 15 minutes, and he never hesitated before cashing in for 1,000 more. Another 1,000 soon followed. Then the dice got hot, and Derek won $1,800 in 5 minutes. He bought more chips. The beers kept coming. The blondes started flirting. The pit boss asked if he wanted to become a gold member of the Nugget. He lost track of the money. He pulled it from all four pockets, then he replaced some of it. He bought more chips. After an hour, he was down $6,000 and wanted desperately to quit. But his luck had to change. The dice had been hot earlier, they'd get hot again. He decided to keep betting heavily, and when his luck turned, he'd get it all back. Another beer, and he switched to scotch. After a bad run, he pulled himself away from the table and returned to the men's room, same stall. He locked it and pulled loose bills from all four pockets. Down to $7,000, and he felt like crying. But he had to get it back. He decided to go out there and reclaim his money. He'd try a different table. He'd alter his betting. And regardless of what happened, he would throw up his hands and bolt from the floor if, God help him, his pot dwindled down to $5,000. There was no way he'd lose the last $5,000. He walked past a roulette table with no players and on a whim placed $500 chips on red. The dealer spun, red played, Derek made $500. He left the chips on red and won again. With no hesitation, he left the $2,000 chips on red and won for the third straight time, $4,000 in less than 5 minutes. He got a beer in the sports bar and watched a boxing match. Wild shouting from the crap pit told him to stay away. He felt fortunate to have almost $11,000 in his pocket. It was past time for visiting Angel, but he had to see her. He purposely walked through the rows of slot machines as far away from the crap tables as he could get. He walked fast, hoping to reach the front door before changing his mind and racing toward the dice. He made it. He'd driven for only a minute, it seemed, when he saw blue lights behind him. It was a City of Biloxi police car, fast on his bumper, headlights flickering. Derek had no mints or gum. He stopped, got out of the car, and waited for orders from the cop, who got up close and immediately smelled alcohol. "Been drinking?" he asked. "Oh, you know, a couple beers at the casino." The cop checked Derek's eyes with a blinding flashlight, then made him walk a straight line and touch his nose with his fingers. Derek was obviously drunk. He was handcuffed and taken to jail. He consented to a breath test and registered .18. There were lots of questions about the cash stuffed in his pockets. The explanation made sense. He'd had a good night at the casino. But he had no job. He lived with a brother, no criminal record. The jailer listed his cash and other pocket items and locked it all away in a vault. Derek sat on a top bunk in the drunk tank with two winos moaning on the floor. A phone would not help because he couldn't call Angel direct. A 5-hour stay was mandatory for drunk drivers. He had to reach Angel before she left for court. The phone woke Swanson at 3:30 Monday morning. The voice on the other end was thick and groggy, the words slurred, but obviously belonging to Beverly Monk. "Welcome to the Big Apple," she said loudly, then laughed crazily, bombed out of her mind. "Where are you?" Swanson demanded. "I've got the money." "Later," she said. Then he heard two angry male voices in the background. "We'll do it later." Someone turned up the music. "I need the information fast."
"And I need the money."
"Great. Tell me when and where."
"Oh, I don't know," she said, then yelled an obscenity at someone in the room.
Swanson gripped the receiver tighter. "Look, Beverly, listen to me. You remember that little coffee shop where we met last time?"
"Yeah, I think."
"On 8th, near Balducci's."
"Oh, yeah."
"Good. Meet me there as soon as you can."
"How soon is that?"
she asked, then erupted in laughter. Swanson was patient. "How about 7 o'clock?
"What time is it now?"
3:30.
"Wow.
Look, why don't I come get you right now? Tell me where you are and I'll grab a cab.
Oh, I'm okay. Just having some fun.
You're drunk.
So?
So if you want this $4,000, you better stay sober enough to meet me.
I'll be there, baby. What's your name again?
Swanson.
Right, Swanson. I'll be there at 7. Or close to it.
She laughed as she hung up. Swanson didn't bother to sleep again. At 5:30, Marvis Maples presented himself to the jailer and asked if he could collect his brother, Derek. The 5 hours were up. The jailer retrieved Derek from the drunk tank, then unlocked a metal tray and placed it on the counter. Derek inventoried the contents of the tray, $11,000 in cash, car keys, pocket knife, lip balm, as his brother stared in disbelief. In the parking lot, Marvis asked about the cash, and Derek explained he'd had a good night at the crap tables. He gave Marvis $200 and asked if he could borrow his car. Marvis took the money and agreed to wait at the jail until Derek's car was brought from the city lot. Derek raced to pass Christian and parked behind the Siesta Inn just as the sky was dawning in the east. He crouched low in case anyone happened by and sneaked through shrubbery until he came to the window of Angel's room. It was locked, of course, and he began pecking on it. There was no response, and so he picked up a small rock and tapped louder. Daylight was landing all around him, and he was beginning to panic.
"Freeze!"
came a loud voice very near his back. Derek jerked around to see Chuck, the uniformed deputy, aiming a long, shiny black pistol at his forehead. He waved the gun.
"Get away from that window! Hands up!"
Derek raised his hands and stepped through the shrubbery.
"On the ground!"
was the next command, and Derek went spread-eagle on the cold sidewalk, hands behind him. Chuck radioed for help. Marvis was still loitering around the jail, waiting for Derek's car when his brother returned for his second arrest of the night. Angel slept through it all. Chapter 38. It was a shame the juror who'd been the most diligent, listened more carefully than the others, remembered more of what had been said, and obeyed every one of Judge Harkin's rules, would be the last one bumped, and thus prevented from affecting the verdict. As reliable as the clock itself, Mrs. Herman Grimes arrived in the dining room at exactly 7:15, took a tray, and began gathering the same breakfast items she had been gathering for almost 2 weeks. Bran cereal, skim milk, and a banana for Herman, cornflakes, 2% milk, a strip of bacon, and apple juice for herself. As he often did, Nicholas met her at the buffet and offered to help. He still prepared Herman's coffee throughout the day in the jury room, and he felt obligated to help in the morning. 2 sugars and 1 cream for Herman, black for Mrs. Grimes. They chatted about whether or not they were packed and ready to go. She seemed genuinely excited at the prospect of eating dinner at home Monday night. The mood had been downright festive throughout the morning as Nicholas and Henry Vu held court at the dining table and greeted the early stragglers. They were going home. Mrs. Grimes reached for the silverware, and Nicholas quickly dropped 4 small tablets into Herman's coffee while saying something about the lawyers. It wouldn't kill him. It was methergine, an obscure prescription drug used primarily in emergency rooms to revive bodies which were all but dead. Herman would be a sick man for 4 hours, then recover completely. As he often did, Nicholas followed her down the hall to their room, carrying the tray and chatting on about this and that. She thanked him generously. Such a nice young man. The commotion hit 30 minutes later, and Nicholas was in the middle of it. Mrs. Grimes stepped into the hallway and yelled at Chuck, who was sitting at his post, sipping coffee and reading the newspaper. Nicholas heard her call and rushed from his room. Something was wrong with Herman. Lou Dell and Willis arrived amid panicked voices, and soon most of the jurors were outside the Grimes' room, where the door was open and people were swarming. Herman was on the bathroom floor, bent double at the waist, clutching his stomach and in terrible pain. Mrs. Grimes and Chuck crouched over him. Lou Dell ran to the phone and called 911. Nicholas said gravely to Ricky Coleman that it was chest pains, maybe a heart attack. Herman had already had one 6 years earlier. Within minutes, everyone knew Herman was suffering from cardiac arrest. The paramedics arrived with a stretcher, and Chuck pushed the other jurors farther down the hall.
Herman was stabilized and given oxygen. His blood pressure was only slightly above normal. Mrs. Grimes said repeatedly it reminded her of his first heart attack. They rolled him out and pushed him rapidly down the hall. In the confusion, Nicholas managed to knock over Herman's coffee cup. The sirens wailed as Herman was sped away. The jurors retreated to their rooms to try and settle their frazzled nerves. Lou Dell called Judge Harkin to tell him Herman had fallen violently ill. The consensus was he'd had another heart attack.
"They're dropping like flies," she said,
then went on to recollect how she'd never lost so many jurors in her 18 years as the jury madam. Harkin cut her off. He really didn't expect her to arrive promptly at 7 for coffee and the cash. Just a few hours earlier, she'd been smashed and gave no indication of relenting, so how could he expect her to keep this appointment? He ate a long breakfast and read the first of many newspapers. 8 o'clock came and went. He moved to a better table near the window so he could watch the people on the sidewalk hustle by. At 9, Swanson called her apartment and managed to pick another fight with the same roommate. No, she was not there, had not been there all night, and maybe she'd moved anyway. "This is someone's daughter," he told himself, living from loft to loft, day to day, scrounging for food and enough money to stay alive and buy the next round of chemicals. Did her parents know what she was doing? He had plenty of time to consider these matters. At 10, he ordered dry toast because the waiter was staring now, obviously irritated that Swanson had evidently camped out for the day. Fueled by rumors that were apparently well-founded, Pinex Common opened strong. After closing Friday at 73, it jumped to 76 at the opening bell and was at 78 within minutes. There was good news out of Biloxi, though no one seemed to know the source. All tobacco stocks rose quickly in early, heavy trading. Judge Harkin didn't appear until almost 9:30, and when he stepped to the bench, he noted, without surprise, that his courtroom was packed. He'd just finished a heated argument with Rohr and Cable, the latter of whom wanted a mistrial because another juror had been removed. There were insufficient grounds for a mistrial. Harkin had done his homework. He'd even found an old case allowing 11 jurors to decide a civil case. 9 votes had been required, but the jury's verdict had been upheld by the Supreme Court. As expected, news of Herman's cardiac arrest spread quickly among the many watching the trial. The jury consultants hired by the defense quietly declared it a major victory for their side because Herman was obviously pro-plaintiff. The jury consultants hired by the plaintiff assured Rohr and Company that Herman's removal was a major blow to the defense because Herman was obviously pro-tobacco. All jury experts claimed to welcome the addition of Shine Royce, though most had difficulty with their reasoning. Fitch just sat in stunned amazement. How in hell do you give someone a heart attack? Was Marley cold-blooded enough to poison a blind man? Thank God she was on his side. The door opened. The jurors filed in. Everyone watched to make sure Herman was, in fact, not among them. His seat was empty. Judge Harkin had talked to a doctor at the hospital, and he began by telling the jurors that Herman appeared to be responding well, that perhaps it was not as serious as initially thought. The jurors, especially Nicholas, were mightily relieved. Shine Royce became juror number 5 and took Herman's old seat on the front row between Philip Savelle and Angel Wees. Shine was right proud of himself. When all was settled and still, His Honor instructed Wendell Rohr to begin his final summation. "Keep it under an hour," he warned. Rohr, wearing his favorite gaudy jacket but with a starched shirt and clean bow tie, began softly by apologizing for the length of the trial and thanking them for being such a wonderful jury. With the friendly remarks behind him, he launched into a vicious description of the deadliest consumer product ever manufactured, the cigarette. It kills 400,000 Americans each year, 10 times more than illegal drugs. No other product comes close. He hit the high points of the testimony of Drs. Frick, Bronski, and Kilvan, and he did so without belaboring what they'd said. He reminded them of Lawrence Krigler, a man who'd worked in the industry and knew its dirty secrets. He spent 10 minutes talking casually about Leon Robilio, the voiceless one who'd worked for 20 years promoting tobacco, then realized how corrupt the industry was. Roar hit his stride when he got around to the kids. For Big Tobacco to survive, it must hook teenagers and ensure the next generation will buy its products. As if he'd been listening in the jury room, Roar asked the jurors to ask themselves how old they'd been when they started smoking. 3,000 kids a day pick up the habit. A third of these will eventually die from it. What else had to be said? Wasn't it time to force these rich corporations to stand behind their products? Time to get their attention? Time to make them leave our children alone? Time to make them pay for the damages caused by their products? He turned nasty when he dwelt on nicotine and Big Tobacco's stubborn insistence that it is not addictive. Former drug addicts had testified that it was easier to quit marijuana and cocaine than cigarettes. He got even meaner when he mentioned Jankel and his abuse theory. Then he blinked once and was a different person. He talked about his client, Mrs. Celeste Wood, a fine wife, mother, friend, a real victim of the tobacco industry. He talked about her husband, the deceased Mr. Jacob Wood, who'd gotten hooked on Bristol's, the star of the Pinex product line, and tried to kick the habit for 20 years. He left behind children and grandchildren, dead at the age of 51 because he'd used a legally manufactured product precisely in the manner in which it was supposed to be used. He stepped to a white marker board on a tripod and did some quick math. The monetary value of Jacob Wood's life was, say, $1 million. He added in some other damages, and the total became $2 million. These were the actual damages, monetary amounts the family was entitled to because of Jacob's death. But the case wasn't about actual damages. Roar delivered a mini-lecture on punitive damages and their role in keeping corporate America in line. How do you punish a company that has $800 million in cash? You get the company's attention. Roar was careful not to suggest a figure, though legally he could have. He simply left $800 million cash in bold print on the board as he returned to the lectern and finished his remarks. He thanked the jury again and sat down. 48 minutes. His Honor declared a 10-minute recess. She was 4 hours late, but Swanson could have hugged her nonetheless. He didn't, though, because he feared infectious diseases and because she was escorted by a grimy young man in black leather from toe to cap, jet black hair and goatee dyed. The word Jade was tattooed impressively in the center of his forehead, and he wore a handsome collection of earrings on both sides of his head. Jade said nothing as he pulled a chair close and perched on guard like a Doberman. Beverly appeared to have been beaten. Her lower lip was cut and puffy. She'd tried to cover a bruise on her cheek with makeup. The corner of her right eye was swollen. She smelled of rancid pot smoke and cheap bourbon, and she was on something, probably speed. With little provocation, Swanson could have slapped Jade across his tattoo and slowly ripped out the earrings. "Have you got the money?" she asked, glancing at Jade, who stared blankly at Swanson, no doubt where the money was going. "Yes. Tell me about Claire."
"Let me see the money."
Swanson removed a small envelope, opened it slightly to reveal the bills, then tucked it under both hands on the table. $4,000. Now talk quickly," he said, glaring at Jade. Beverly looked at Jade, who nodded like a bad actor, and said, "Go ahead."
"Her real name is Gabrielle Brandt. She's from Columbia, Missouri. She went to college at the university there where her mother taught medieval studies. That's all I know."
"What about her father?"
"I think he's dead."
"Anything else?"
"No. Give me the money."
Swanson slid it across the table and immediately jumped to his feet. "Thanks," he said, and disappeared. It took Durwood Cable slightly more than half an hour to skillfully discount the ridiculous notion of giving millions to the family of a man who'd voluntarily smoked for 35 years. The trial was hardly more than a naked grab for money. What he resented most about the plaintiff's case was that they had attempted to shift the issues away from Jacob Wood and his habits and turn the trial into an emotional debate on teenage smoking. What did Jacob Wood have to do with current cigarette advertising?
There wasn't an ounce of proof that the late Mr. Wood had been influenced by an ad campaign. He had started smoking because he chose to start. Why bring the kids into this fight? Emotion, that's why. We respond angrily when we think children are being hurt or manipulated, and before the plaintiff's lawyers can convince you, the jurors, to hand them a fortune, they must first make you angry. Cable deftly appealed to their sense of fairness. Decide the case on its facts, not on emotions. When he finished, he had their complete attention. As he took his seat, Judge Harkin thanked him and said to the jury, "Ladies and gentlemen, the case now belongs to you. I suggest you select a new foreman to take the place of Mr. Grimes, who I'm told is doing much better. I talked to his wife during the last recess, and he is still quite ill, but expected to recover fully. If for any reason you need to speak to me, please notify Madam Clerk. The rest of your instructions will be handed to you in the jury room. Good luck." As Harkin bid them farewell, Nicholas turned slightly to the audience and locked eyes with Rankin Fitch, just a brief acknowledgement of where matters were at the moment. Fitch nodded, and Nicholas stood with his colleagues. It was almost noon. Court was in recess, subject to the call of the bench, which meant that those who wanted to were free to loiter about until the jury reached a verdict. The horde from Wall Street sprinted out to call their offices, the big four CEOs mingled with underlings for a moment, then made their way out of the courtroom. Fitch left immediately and went to his office. Conrad was hovering over a bank of phones. "It's her," he said anxiously. "She's calling from a pay phone." Fitch walked even faster to his office, where he grabbed his phone. "Hello?" "Fitch, look, new wiring instructions. Put me on hold and go to your fax." Fitch looked at his private fax, which was transmitting. "It's right here," he said. "Why new instructions?" "Shut up, Fitch. Just do as I say, and do it immediately." Fitch yanked the fax from his machine and skimmed the handwritten message. The money was now headed to Panama, Banco Atlantico in Panama City. She had routing instructions and account numbers. "You have 20 minutes, Fitch. The jury is eating lunch. If I don't have a confirmation by 12:30, then the deal is off and Nicholas changes directions. He has a cell phone in his pocket, and he's waiting for me to call." "Call back at 12:30, Fitch said, hanging up. He told Conrad to hold all calls, no exceptions. He immediately faxed her message to his wiring expert in D.C., who in turn faxed the necessary authorization to Hanwha Bank in the Netherlands Antilles. Hanwha had been on standby all morning, and within 10 minutes the money left Fitch's account and bounced across the Caribbean to the bank in Panama City, where it had been expected. A confirmation from Hanwha was faxed to Fitch, who at the moment would have loved to fax it to Marley, but he didn't have her number. At 12:20, Marley called her banker in Panama, who confirmed the receipt of $10 million. Marley was in a motel room 5 miles away, working with a portable fax. She waited 5 minutes, then sent instructions to the same banker to wire the money to a bank in the Cayman Islands. All of it, and once it's gone, close the account in Banco Atlantico. Nicholas called at exactly 12:30. He was hiding in the men's room. Lunch was over, and it was time to start the deliberations. Marley said the money was safe and that she was leaving. Fitch waited until almost 1. She called from another payphone. "The money has arrived, Fitch," she said. "Great. How about lunch?" "Maybe later." "So when can we expect a verdict?" "Late afternoon. I hope you're not worried, Fitch."
"Me? Never."
"Just relax. It'll be your finest hour. 12 to zip, Fitch. How does that sound?"
"Like music. Why'd you bump poor old Herman?"
"Don't know what you're talking about."
"Yeah, right. When can we celebrate?"
"I'll call you later." She sped away in a rented car, watching every movement behind her. Her leased car was sitting in front of her condo, abandoned for all she cared. In the back seat, she had 2 bags stuffed with clothing, the only personal item she could pack, along with the portable fax. The furniture in the condo would belong to whoever bought it at a sidewalk sale. She looped through a subdivision, a run she'd practiced yesterday in case anyone wanted to follow. Fitch's boys weren't behind her. She zigzagged through side streets until she came to the Gulfport Municipal Airport, where the small Lear jet was waiting. She grabbed her 2 bags and locked the keys in the car. Swanson called once, but couldn't get through.
He called the supervisor in Kansas City, and three agents were immediately dispatched to Columbia, an hour away. Two more worked the phones, making rapid calls to the University of Missouri, to the Medieval Studies Department, in a desperate attempt to locate someone who knew something and was willing to talk. Six Brants were listed in the Columbia phone book. All were called more than once, and none claimed to know Gabrielle Brant. He finally got Fitch on the phone just after one. Fitch had been barricaded in his office for an hour, taking no calls. Swanson was on his way to Missouri. Chapter 39. When the lunch dishes were cleared and all the smokers had returned from the smoke room, it became apparent that they were now supposed to do what they'd been dreaming about for a month. They took their places around the table and stared at the empty seat at the end, the one Herman had so proudly occupied. Guess we